Yeah, that's a group that you should know by now. The unmistakable sound of Brass Construction, the masters of funk with their 1976 platinum hit, Changin'. Born in Brooklyn in 1968. As a dynamic soul, they changed their names to Brass Construction, and the rest is music and dance history. The nine-member band was a brainchild of Randy Muller, born in Guyana, and the other eight members of this band with a really tight horn section. What was beautiful about Brass Construction is that it was a pan-Caribbean African gathering. It was just fantastic, making great, great, great music. And that was one of my favorites from 1976. It went platinum that year. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And on the third day, there is school in the city of Detroit. The Detroit Federation of Teachers has ended a two-day sick out that shut down 94.7 public schools on Monday and yesterday. And the teachers were told over the weekend that the state's largest school district would run out of money by June the 30th, and their salaries for summer school and even beyond that could not be guaranteed. There was a meeting, as we discussed here yesterday, with Aboyomi Azikiwe. There was a meeting, and at this meeting, apparently some money was found, but it isn't the solution. It is only a temporary stopgap measure, so we'll be finding out what is beyond the summer and whether the state is going to meet its obligation to paying the teachers. Meanwhile, President Obama is in Flint, Michigan today. You see, we are so ahead of these stories. We talked about Detroit and Flint as being templates of what's going to be happening all across this nation. And the plans, literally, for emptying major cities that are predominantly people of color and clearing them out. This is a kind of ethnic cleansing of cities. And we're seeing it playing itself out in stark fashion in the city of Detroit, and as well we're seeing it in Flint, and as we were discussing, the majority black cities of Michigan, of the state of Michigan, are all under some form of emergency management. That is to say that the governor has basically set aside all of the democratic processes in each of these cities, and with the idea that these cities just simply cannot manage themselves. So they will be managed by an appointee of the governor, who will then have essentially absolute rule. Here in the city of Detroit, what we had was a forced bankruptcy. We've revealed that on this program in several episodes. The city of Detroit was a thriving city, and it was in so many ways a wonderful example of the promise made real for people who were from working class backgrounds, people who had migrated from the South and came north to work in the automobile industry, just like the post office. We've done a series on that. The post office offered many people of color in this country their first real shot, as it were, to leading a decent life, having a decent quality of life. The city of Detroit, we are told over and over again, was the example, a national example, of the highest rate of black home ownership. Just like the city of New York, we had a migration of African Americans and people from the Caribbean going into what are now the so-called suburbs, which is mostly Queens and Brooklyn and Harlem, and buying homes and starting businesses and circulating the money within their communities and affording their children a good education and the promise of a good future. And of course, in New York City, we saw that because in 1973 and 74 and in the mid-70s, I was writing about the astounding rate of foreclosures in Queens and in Brooklyn and in these black communities that were the most stable communities. And they had remarkably high percentages of home ownership. These were very stable communities, but they were targeted. The policy at that time was called redlining, which means literally it's like banks drawing a red line around a community and saying, well, no matter what these people do, they will not qualify for loans. And thus began a coordinated effort to make these communities collapse, to just drive them into the ground, so that they become, at some predictable point in time, uninhabitable. This is not news. This is not something that, you know, is a great revelation. Because this has been a pattern, and it has been patented. What we're seeing in Detroit, however, is the systematic application of what I continue to say is the targeting of particular communities so that these communities collapse, they implode, and people, just for mere survival, will have no other choice, as they see it, but to leave. The powers that be will get to say, well, gee, see, they had it really good, and look what they did with it. Just like the state of Michigan is saying that all of these black communities simply cannot manage themselves. They're incapable of self-management. When the record shows a targeted program to disembowel all of these cities, which are now highly prized, and which, because there's this conspiracy among real estate interests and big money and corporations and racist policy makers, to prime the pump to, quote, return America to the way it used to be. Now, this is new. People are identifying this as, you know, a kind of Trump-type call. But this has been the thing that has been going on in black communities and Latino communities all the time, all along. Take, for example, the city of Yonkers, New York. In the city of Yonkers, it's right on the Hudson River, and there's a reason for that. It was the way they transported Africans up the river and dropped them off there. And certainly they settled close to the river. And the coordinated conspiracies kept them there in substandard, practically substandard everything, substandard schools, substandard housing, substandard jobs, but they were there. Now, the real estate interests have decided that, hey, these people have been living down by the river all this time, great vistas of the Hudson River. And so now they're trying to drive them out and reclaim the turf, because now Yonkers has been, quote, re-envisioned. That means ethnically cleansed. That's the program, to just drive all the undesirables out and recreate a city in the image and likeness of the powers that be. And whenever you hear these kinds of phrases, it means with as few, if any, people of color as possible. Just get them out. These programs, and I think this is a very important policy thing to look at across the country. It was done, in some cases, quite violently. The Native Americans, you couldn't ask for a more stark example, but the Trail of Tears, just driven off their lands. Their entire nations lost their tribal lands and were just driven off, everything confiscated. To this day, they have not recuperated from that ethnic program of genocide. African Americans, well, of course, you, by law, you own nothing and you are nothing. So you even have to have constitutional protections to at least address the matter that you deserve to live and breathe. That had to be legislated. So this program that we're seeing today, and the reason I go back to Detroit, is because it is a modern lesson in a historical program of ethnic cleansing in this country. Now, it is very big news today that President Obama is going to Flint. We've talked about the atrocities in Flint, Michigan, where the water has been poisoned. It's so poisoned that not even the automobile industry wants to use the water in their factories. They say it's too corrosive. But what is important to understand about Flint is that this problem has been going on for 2 years. Hundreds of thousands of people have been exposed to super toxic contaminated water, mostly lead, but other horrible contaminants as well, that will have generational effect, because these contaminants are not easily gotten rid of once they are ingested into the body. Now, in any sane or human condition, you would say this constitutes a crime against humanity, really, because they knew this thing was going on. We talked about it here on this program. In fact, the reporter who broke the story was on this program and broke the story on this program as well. And it takes now a president. He's been here. He's been around for 8 years. This problem has been going on for 2 years. His Justice Department hasn't done very much about it. His Environmental Protection Agency has been very, very reluctant and lackadaisical about investigating this matter. And now the people of Flint have to literally implore him, come, please, and help us. This is outrageous to the extreme. It is outrageous. Of course, there's a lot of publicity associated with this. Here's the President of the United States storming into Flint, Michigan on Air Force One, and he's going to have some briefings, and people are going to look to him, you know, well, hope. Just as he's about to put his foot out the door and go on to his post-presidential life, he is now looked upon as a savior for a problem that has been in existence for 2 years already and that has already had serious negative impact on hundreds of thousands of people, the vast majority of whom are people of color. But of course, it is appropriate now because Hillary Clinton, who he is stomping for and who he practically has endorsed, she needs all the help she can get. She suddenly is a lover of Obama. She is there to protect his so-called legacy. And he is there to lend as much clout as possible to her presidential campaign. And this is the cynicism that we see in the way public tragedies are used for political advantage, plain and simple. This is not because there's any deep sense of outrage about it. It is because there's a great deal of symbolism. The cameras will be there. The issue suddenly will be put on the minds of Americans, and the president gets to look really presidential. And this environmental issue fits neatly with platform positions by the various candidates on environmental the environmental climate change and so forth, and all the associated environmental issues. Very cynical. Now, what connects Detroit and Flint is that we see here the application, because I ask all the time, what is a connection? What do you see as a connection, and what does this inform you to do as a presumably politically conscious person? And my take has always been, you punish the heck out of the political parties. You punish them. Because this is not what is supposed to happen. And when they do this to people in Flint, you punish them wherever you are. In behalf of the people of Flint and in behalf of these thousands and thousands of students in Detroit who are, if they're lucky, still have a school, but those schools are overrun by rats and roaches and mold. And children can't get a drink of water during the day. And the teaching is substandard and the textbooks are old and outdated. And teachers are overloaded with work. And these children have already been consigned to the periphery of life by virtue of a substandard education. So when you are in New York and you're talking about voting in New York, your political consciousness has to say, I am going to vote with the people of Flint in mind, with the people of Detroit in mind, and the injustices done to them there, it's as if they were done to me wherever I am. That's what I mean. Now, the interesting thing here is that the Democratic Party will not and cannot survive. It just cannot do it mathematically without strong support from its political base, that base being majority people of color. And they're playing with the lives of people of color all over the country. And doing these, you know, symbolic things. You heard the speech by Hillary Clinton on the Sunday, and then the next day, the teachers walk out. She is talking for the NAACP, talking as a keynote speaker for the NAACP of Detroit. And they're busy applauding a reality that simply does not exist. But for political purposes, they will con themselves into thinking that they're doing the right thing, that they're activists, that they represent somebody. When on practically every single level that you can measure the quality of life, Detroit is not doing well, and Detroiters are not doing well at all. And especially Detroiters of color, not doing well at all. But that invented reality is given to the community on Sunday. And the hard reality hits on Monday. And now on Tuesday, the president, who has yet to find himself in Detroit, talking to the people of Detroit about their school systems that have failed and continue to fail under his administration and his Secretary of State, enacting the most pernicious education policies that we have seen in a long time. In Chicago, hundreds of schools being closed. All across the nation, hundreds of schools, public schools being closed, left, right, and center. In New York City, neighborhood schools being targeted because the real estate interests think they would make great lofts. That's what his Secretary of Education, who needs an education himself, he's hopelessly unqualified for the job. He only has a bachelor's degree. But this is the man this president selected. He's a Clintonite, after all. And selected him to make policy, national policy. What's the national policy? The national policy is that the city of New Orleans does not have a public school system anymore. It doesn't have a public school anymore. And that is the plan. They could say whatever they want to say, but that is the plan. And Detroit is perhaps one of the best examples we have to date about the confluence of interests based on race and class in America to absolutely tear up any hope of progress for people they consider to be dispensable, expendable, not really worth saving. And yet these are the same people who form the bedrock of political support for these two horrible parties. And they go out dutifully and vote for their own annihilation every time. They vote for it. You see, so you have to connect these dots. You have to become conscious this way. You can't see a thing, well, that's Detroit, but I live in Cincinnati, Ohio. Well, this is New York, but that thing is happening in North Carolina. No. What we begin to do is to develop a consciousness. This is the one thing you have. You have some kind of power, at least theoretically, in the vote. So you use the vote as a weapon, a defense weapon. You use it that way. Nobody is to be supported if they come from a party that has this record, period. No party should get your vote. What you should do instead is begin to devise your own systems that directly address your needs. And this is why, again, we go to Flint, we go to Detroit. And next week, I'm hosting a series of programs aimed exactly at this. How ordinary people who have connected the dots are on the move. They're on the move. And their struggles are not limited by geography. Their struggles are very much linked to the fact of the conditions of life all over the country. This is what is needed. We need the parties to know, or political systems to know, that you can't pull something off in Washington, D.C. and think that you're safe because you come from Brooklyn. We take you out because you are with a party that is misbehaving. You got to go. Your party has got to go. And we have something else in mind that will work. That is where we ought to be right now. We shouldn't be asking and wondering, what will Bernie do? We should be asking, what are we doing about Bernie? What are we doing about him? You've got 9 million votes already. You surpassed Jesse Jackson's 7 million. What are you doing with them? What are you doing with them? And why are people allowing this to happen? No accountability. Instead, they stuck with this whole idea that just his candidacy alone and the inroads he's making, that's enough reward. No, it's not. Because this is not Bernie Sanders. In the end, you have to see this as, this is not because of Bernie Sanders. It is happening because people are supporting Bernie Sanders. A decision is being made, a conscious decision is being made to reflect their consciousness that something else is needed. And if in the world of politics you need some agency to express that, he might as well get the support because he's expressing these things. However, I go back to my original theory today. No matter who you are, if your party stinks, if your political orientation stinks, if your political loyalties stink, you don't get support, period. And we are going to hold you accountable. You will obey the will of the people. See, that's how we have to think. We have to stop believing that these issues that confront us every single day are new. They're not. They're simply a continuum of what has been in place for centuries. There's nothing new. Nothing new here. But we do have templates that, if we paid attention to them, if we visit them and decipher them and get to know these things, these theories, these methods, these suggestions, these plans, if we familiarize ourselves with them, we can see that many of them have great merit. It is just that we disrespect them, or we don't know them, or we believe that the people who put them on the table for us to examine, how could they possibly know in the 1800s, in the 1700s, even before the birth of Christ. How could they possibly know how to do these things that are affecting us in 2016? This is why I share tapes with you all the time. If you play a tape by Malcolm X, Elhaj Malik El-Shabazz, you'd think he was just here 15 minutes ago and offering an analysis of what just happened 15 minutes ago. If you hear the words of W.B. Du Bois, if you hear the words of Marcus Garvey, if you hear the words of so many people who have gone before and who Blyden and a whole range of people, Dr. John Henry Clark, so many people, excuse me, there is so much available to educate us about what workable alternatives could look like and what they could achieve. Instead, we are wedded to the idea that the same system that is doing us in is the system that will save us, which is why today the sad part of it is, and I'm not in any way castigating the people of Flint, they're in a desperate situation. But they should not really be looking to Obama for help. They should have canceled his contract 4 years ago based on his performance and other areas that were very important. They should have made it clear. The reason you were elected was for you to make some changes, dramatic changes. Don't tell me you're ready now because you want to support Hillary Clinton before you go, and because this is good public relations and this is a really wonderful photo op. No, this is strictly business here. We can't get emotional about these things. People are wedded to the idea that the system, they have to support a system because that is where salvation will come from. That is where solutions will come from. That is where the answer is. And we have to ask, I mean, what mind-altering drug have you been taking? The system is not going to help you. It's not designed to help you. It's not designed to promote all these wonderful, lofty ideas that it talks about freedom and justice and equality. Absolutely not. It cannot survive if it promoted freedom, justice, and equality. The system will not survive. The system likes the idea of rugged individualism, which is death for most communities, especially communities of color. But there's no point to rugged individualism. Our very survival is in the exact opposite direction. We need more communal action. We need more aggregation of talent, and we need more close relationships with each other. But the system, if we had this kind of community organization and it got tighter and tighter and more efficient and more effective, it means it automatically the destruction of a system which thrives on fractioning everything, breaking it up so that it is the monopoly, not you. The system doesn't really want to encourage freedom. Why? Why would it do something that crazy? If you're free, then it means you are inhibiting and containing its power. The idea of a system, the ultimate thing is control. You can't they don't go well together. Control and freedom, they don't go together. They are polar opposites. So by definition, if you are about freedom, you cannot support a system that is founded on the business of control. You want equality. Does the system want equality? Does it promote equality? Really? No, it doesn't. Because this is a class system. Automatically, it means there is differentiation. When you have equality, it means that you're dedicated to erasing those lines of differentiation, which means you are working exactly the opposite way from the way the system intends to work. So when you look to the system to solve your problems, it means that you have a mind-altering challenge on your hands. You have lost your senses. Here in this moment where the presidential elections are occurring and people are all excited, who's going to get the nomination? It is the system taking care of its business. The question is, why aren't we? Why aren't we taking care of our business? In another 4 years, there will be another parade, another set of dogs and ponies running around, begging for your vote. And it's all a game. And there'll be people doing the same thing all over again, basically pledging their troth to a system that has no real evidence to show that it consistently promotes the things that the people want, that it gives the people what they want and need. It doesn't have a good record of doing that. So why support it? What is your alternative? And in this regard, I don't really get too hung up about political ideologies. I'm interested in how do you identify a need? And what do you propose to do to meet that need? What will the benefits be? What will the challenges be? How do you plan to overcome them so that you get some kind of modest success? That's the beef I have with the Green Party. Year after year, cycle after cycle, you're running and you're losing. And it doesn't yet occur to you that maybe you need to rethink your formula. To the point where losing has become so predictable that it actually has anesthetized people. It has numbed us. No. If you're interested in doing something and achieving a goal, you also have to indicate what you're doing to make that goal possible and achievable. That's what you have to do. It's a simple thing. And I'm not talking about the grandiose kinds of plans where you're going to raise X hundreds of billions of dollars and you're going to have this fantastic national campaign. No, just take something small, but achieve everything you set out to achieve in that something small.
Something that is perfectly achievable. It's doable. Of course, not necessarily easy, but it could work. And you can make it work. You have what is necessary to make it work. The idea was to teach people how to write. And teach them how to write at a level that they can make a living that way. I did not require a college degree. All I required was, you have a high school diploma, fine. You're unemployed, great. I'll take that. You are 18 years of age or older, Fine. I'll take those three qualifiers and we can start. However, if you give me 20 weeks of your life, 20 weeks, I can take you from zero to writer in 20 weeks, and you'll do very well. I'm not promising you that it's going to be easy. I'm telling you that you will get 100% of what it is I can offer and a team of people I have organized to offer you. I have put together a curriculum that could get you up and running quickly. And if you make your end of the bargain, your priority for 20 weeks, you're good to go. Now, I have some strange rules, and we're not going to discuss them. There's no negotiating about them. You are late twice to my program. I ask you to leave. You missed two deadlines. I ask you to leave. You see? And once we have this thing established, we're good to go. And so said, so done. We conducted this program for 4 years, and in the 4 years, we were rated by the New York State Department of Labor as one of the best training programs in the state. Now, what did we have? People would come, professors from all these journalism schools heard about the program. They wanted to see what was there and what were we doing and all of this kind of stuff. And when they came, they were shocked. We had one big room, just one room, that put everybody in the one room, just like a regular newsroom. And our standard equipment at the time was Royal Manual typewriters. People were shocked. It was, wait a minute, you're teaching people how to write, and this is as far as you go? Yeah. My theory was very simple. If you're writing junk on a Royal Manual typewriter, you will write it only faster on a computer. I didn't mind it. That's what we could afford. But what you didn't see was the dedication and the high standards and the effort poured into every participant in that program. And so it worked because we intended it to work. We had a 93% graduation rate, 93%. In fact, some of the people you see on CNN and other places came right out of my little program. But that's the point I'm making. You start where you can start best and where you think you have the best chance of succeeding at a simple idea. It doesn't have to be all complex. You don't have to take on the world. Just a little piece of territory that you can do better than anybody else and that you are fairly certain that you could execute that plan and bring it to fruition successfully. A small party with that kind of guts would have achieved and will achieve results in a short time. It may not be spectacular. This is why I go back to Jesse Jackson. You had 7 million people and 11 million people giving you a vote. That was an investment. And that should have served as the launching pad for a vigorous alteration of the political landscape in this country back in 1984. What have you done with it since 1984? Where does it exist? this rainbow coalition that they keep bandying around, where does it exist? What is it doing? And of what use is it? Or what use has it been to the people in Detroit, to the people in Flint? You see, that's how we change things politically. You hold these people accountable, as I did. I ran an African-American newspaper, a very vibrant, vigorous one, very strident, and exposed Jesse Jackson. I said he was a charlatan and that he had to account for all of these votes that he took and ran to the Democratic Party with, put all those people on the auction block, gave all that support as if it was his own. It just wasn't his own. And we're seeing the formation of the same mindset in Bernie Sanders. Nobody is asking him the tough questions. What are you doing with these votes, these 9 million votes that you already have? Don't tell me it's all about reshaping the Democratic Party. We have no use for the Democratic Party. Don't tell me it's about, well, including some progressive platforms in the progressive planks in the party's platform. We have no use for that because all that is cosmetic fluff. But we got to get to the point of making small changes that have huge impact and that we stay the course with until we see them to conclusion with a science, because you have to have a method. You have to have the guts to stick it through. And you have to have the tenacity to not cave in the face of challenges. So we couldn't get computers. All right, so we could get some Royal Manual typewriters at $35 a piece. That's what we have. If you're brilliant at writing with a Royal typewriter, you'll be brilliant at writing at a computer. See? You see where the important thing is, what's important and what's not. The Urban League has sumptuous offices, and the NAACP National Office, very sumptuous offices and so forth. But where is the spirit of fighting in the streets rather than, you know, deciding whether you should get your tux ready for the next gala dinner and whether you're going to have a champagne sip with insiders or whether you were invited to the party of the year and which next dinner are you going to host so that you can invite all this corporate underwriting. You're not in the fight. You don't have fight left in you. Early on, the National Urban League signaled Hillary Clinton, vote for Hillary. The NAACP, vote for Hillary. All these national organizations that should be screaming in behalf of people like the people in Flint and the people in Detroit and the people in Chicago and the people in South Carolina, they don't have that fight in them anymore. They've been co-opted. They've been bought. In fact, some of them even sold themselves. They didn't have to be bought. They volunteered to be bought. Because they made themselves, they rendered themselves completely impotent to struggle. The people of Flint have to wait 2 years. Hundreds of thousands of people are poisoned. This is chemical genocide. And the NAACP right across the road is having a dinner and inviting Hillary to talk about the wonderful things that are happening in the state of Michigan. So you see, there's a disconnect. And it is up to us to devise new systems that work. Again, it doesn't have to be all this huge tra-la-la. It simply requires muscle and dedication and a plan, a scientific plan, a method, a system that will deliver the results that you're looking for. We have a lot of those available to look at and examine. You don't like this one, you can borrow some from that one. But we have to get to the point of beginning the work and not act as, you know, sideseers and people who are just on the sidelines. This is the job that we have wherever we are. So I thank you so much for joining me today. I want you to know how appreciative I am of your continued support and your encouraging messages and notes. I really, really appreciate that. And I want you to stay tuned. Coming up next, the NDC Savings Club, more information on the station. And I want you also to consider consistently supporting PRN with your donations. The revolution, freedom isn't free, as a friend of mine continues to say, you should support those things that are supporting you. And PRN is supporting you by providing information that you do not have ready access to every day. You know, so this is important to do. This is important work to do. And I thank you for considering supporting PRN financially. You can also reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. And it's a pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.